from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight we have a busy show ahead of us. We're going to talk about Casey Anthony, Charles Manson, you name it. We're going to talk about all of the people you love to hate the most. Somebody that we don't hate here on Scared Monkeys Radio is Blink from Blink on Crime. It's always a pleasure to have her here. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, and that is good news.
No, we love you here, that's for sure. I tell you, the story that we want to talk about is Casey Anthony. Every time I talk about Casey Anthony, and for the, what's it been, 2 years now, or however long it's been, I usually get in trouble a little bit, so I'll have to mind my P's and Q's tonight. But we certainly don't want to anger one of the strong supporters for Casey Anthony, is Geraldo. Oops, did I say that? Sorry. We'll have to, Justin, edit that out a little bit later. Actually, no, don't you dare, because I'm amazed to see that some of the cable news hosts, some that I won't name, but maybe have mustaches and are on the weekends, how they cater to Jose Baez is beyond me. But let's talk about some of the new things going on with Casey Anthony.
Sure, Dana. It's a frustrating case that has gone on this long. But this week in particular, I would say actually maybe over the last 2 weeks, there's been some new developments. And part of that is because Chief Judge Belvin Perry has put in some deadlines that were not in place before to facilitate the trial, which is now scheduled to begin in May, to start on time and to really just, you know, kind of eradicate the ridiculousness of some of the filings that have gone on through the defense team.
Yep.
Headed by Jose Baez. As you know, I think they're on their 11th or 12th lawyer, which is no exaggeration. Since we spoke last, Linda Kenny Bodden had resigned from the defense team that she quickly followed Andrea Lyon, some of the strongest legal minds, you know, arguably, in the community. But recently, the state, vis-a-vis Jeff Ashton, went to court and said to, in essence, to Chief Judge Perry that right now they were not getting reciprocal discovery. And what he meant by that was he displayed an email exchange between himself and Jose Baez, which honestly, I thought I was watching Romper Room. I couldn't even believe that a sworn officer of the court and lead counsel in a capital murder case would email that the botanist expert witness was going to testify about, you guessed it, botany. Under that set of specifications, since I got an A on my leaf collection in the 7th grade,
yeah,
I would absolutely be worthy of such a title. That's how ridiculous it was. But interestingly, and those of us that have been reporting on the case and developed networks in the case from the beginning, I feel strongly that one of the reasons that was done was because they were trying to hold their cards close to the vest with regard to their defense strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And I published an article the other day, which, in my opinion, is exactly what they're looking to prove. And that is a Chiari 1 malformation, undiagnosed, undetected, resulting in the natural death of Kaylee Marie Anthony. Before you blow your top like the rest of us, we certainly don't believe that's what happened.
No.
But I do feel strongly that that is the direction that they are going to present.
Yeah, Blink from Blink on Crime is here. How long has this been going on since when she was arrested?
Kaylee Marie Anthony, just 34 months old, was reported missing by her grandmother, Cynthia Anthony, on July the evening of July 15th, 2008.
Wow.
Into the early morning hours of July 16th, Casey was arrested on July 16th. As you know, she was also bonded out by the Padillas et al. At some point, and she was indicted for capital murder on October 14th
right.
in 2008 and has not, again, been bonded out.
And all the lies and all the deception and all the media and all the garbage that's gone on. In fact, I came across something the other day with this so-called George Anthony's girlfriend, River Phoenix or
sure.
River, Deep River, or whatever her name is. I don't know.
River Dance.
That River Dance. That's it. Yeah, yeah. Right. Oh, my God. I couldn't believe anybody would give her 3 seconds of time on the air.
Right.
But anyway, besides that, this is a classic case of the defense changing lawyers. They're catching up to Oksana now. I think she has 40, and they'll probably have that by the time this is done. Trying to do whatever they can to delay the inevitable, I believe. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that they have done that because they honestly, here's my personal opinion, is that Jose Baez was in his third year of practice.
Right.
You're talking about a lawyer. He's classified under the Florida bar rules as what's called a young lawyer. He had no business taking a potential capital case. There isn't any attorney I've discussed this with, and I've discussed it with several in Florida, that had any business taking a case of this magnitude. Now, you can argue that when he originally took the case, it was not a capital case or a potential for a capital case, didn't know that, etc. Regardless, what he did was he got a deal for over $270,000, which funded his defense of his client. Under those rules, that is a no-no.
Yeah.
And repeatedly, in my opinion, has broken the rules, almost egregiously, for professional rules and responsibilities under the bar, and has gotten, in my opinion, away with a lot of it because he is classified as a young lawyer, and also because I think that community was concerned that it would, you know, even delay the process even more. And go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish up.
And when Chaney Mason signed on, I really felt strongly, given his reputation and his propensity to facilitate plea bargains,
yeah,
effectively, with his over 30 years of experience, that was imminent. I just didn't see him as, at this late stage of his career, getting involved in something like this unless he was going to have a direct impact positively. I take it all back.
And yeah, I remember you and I talking about just that. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, blinkoncrime.com, talking about Casey Anthony and poor little Kaylee. When you go to blinkoncrime.com, there's an interesting article about some dogs. The defense has gone to the dogs or something like that.
Yes.
It's laughable, actually. But and I love the comment Red made on the forum part. Let's get into that.
Yeah, yes. Right. When the defense released the reports, which they were ordered to do as a result of the state's motion, where they were more specific, and in this case were not, when it comes to Michael Freeman, who I believe the understated state star witness. They're trying to pretend, you know, play that his work isn't finished on the case and they're not really sure what he's going to say. I think it all goes back to not wanting to avail their, you know, defense strategy, like this is going to be some sort of Perry Mason moment. With regard to one of their experts, Dr. Fairgraves, he is well known for his work on a case that just resulted in an acquittal. It was not a murder case because the prosecution could not determine that it was a homicide, but it had to do with cadaver dogs having alerts within the home, and there was no biological evidence to back up those alerts. And in their report, I mean, again, Jose Baez outlines, you know, she has a Sixth Amendment right to confront her accuser, intimating that the dog and she would need to have an exchange. And therefore, you know, the result, what they're trying to do is eliminate the hits
right.
that occurred at the Anthony home, although they were nonspecific, and what I posed in my piece was it wasn't just at the Anthony home. It was also corroborated in the evidence bay in a closed car
right.
where the dog hit on the trunk, where, by the way, hmm. their client's latent print, which most people missed, is on the back of.
Yeah.
Pizza. And it's just, it's insulting.
Pizza.
To the process. It's insulting. I've personally met those dogs.
Have you?
And they're charming.
Yeah. But it was all pizza, though, wasn't it?
Right. And, you know, I think I want to caution another thing that I don't think a lot of people picked up on, and that has to do with the entomologists in this case. And Dr. Neil Haskell, who arguably is the most preeminent entomologist in this case, has concluded and is concurred by the defense that there were no coffin flies found. And what they're saying is that indicates that Kaylee Marie, decomposed somewhere other than where she was ultimately recovered.
Hmm.
And I'm going to tell you, because I haven't been wrong yet, and I promise you I just jinxed myself. And I will be. But in this case, I feel strongly that is coming back to, unfortunately, her playhouse in the Anthony backyard.
Where it all started, yeah.
I believe so. I believe she hid her in the first few days underneath that playhouse. And once she got the word that the Anthonys were renovating the backyard about a week later is when I think she moved her. And it does seem to make sense with the little drips and drabs that we're getting in terms of the reporting.
Absolutely. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We'll talk about the disclosure in Florida in a minute. You know, Blink, in the 13 years I've done this show, I can name the guests that I've had the most hate mail about, but yet the most listenership about. Drew Peterson, Julia Renfro, Joe Tacopina. I just made some notes to myself. Boy, I got a lot of angry email when I had those three on. But the one I got the most...
Is a lot of that from Red?
Yeah, well, no. A little bit from him, but from a lot of people. But the one I got the most angry email about was Cindy Anthony. And when I interviewed her, and I can remember very plainly talking to George. He didn't want to come on, talked to him on the phone for a half hour, and found him to be a very easy guy to talk to. He was quite sincere, almost skittish, if I can use that term. But talking to Cindy, she reminded me of the Marine drill sergeant bossing. I've talked to a lot of victims' parents, and I understand that she was looking for her granddaughter and stuff, but boy, did the tables turn with her, and I had her on very early in this case. How important will Cindy and George Anthony be when it comes to trial time?
They're going to be very important. They're going to be critically important, and one of the reasons that I feel that way is I think there's two situations going on. I feel strongly that if, in fact, they are going to present the defense that I believe they are, and that is that Kaylee died of a natural death,
right.
and that their client panicked, and, I don't know, was protecting someone else, as ridiculous as it sounds, she's going to need to take the stand, and she's going to need to accuse someone. You can't just think you're going to get away with, you know, presenting a halfway defensible case without those strategies in place, in my opinion. And I believe that the brunt of that is going to be her father.
Mm.
He himself has put himself in that position by, in my opinion, lying to law enforcement, specifically on the 16th of June, where he stated that he did not see Casey or Kaylee until they were going to leave the home. Did not even come out of their bedroom until 12:50 p.m., where we now know from the cell phone ping studies that Casey never left that house until 4:16 p.m. that day. So we know conclusively that George was deceptive. The question becomes why. And following the theory that it's possible that she moved the baby right around the 24th is the second time he says that he saw Casey and she returned the gas cans. I don't believe that ever happened. I don't believe he ever saw her that day. It's not logical. I think that through defense counsel, they were able to coach the parents about what they needed to say on what days. Because let's not forget, that gas can information did not come out until the Anthonys were in front of the FBI.
Right.
They had had several interviews, and it was not until then. And they were told prior to their interview with Scott Ballen, Agent Scott Ballen, that lying to a federal agent is a felony. That is a crime. You cannot be deceptive to a federal agent. So I think that that's part of what you're going to see. And then I think there's going to be a bit of divide and conquer. I think Cindy and George are crushing under the weight. I think George was involved in a lot of extracurricular activities that not only should he not have been involved in, but that he was not honest about, that are damning to him, and well, certainly damning to the marriage, of course. And I think if he was smart, if I were to advise him in any way, it would be to tell the truth. Now,
yeah.
Tell the truth.
I agree.
Save yourself. Be the bilge pump. Do right by your granddaughter and be honest. Because I don't think there's a hope. There may be no hope for him, but I definitely do not believe that Cindy Anthony has the capacity to be truthful and do right by her granddaughter. I really do not.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. And we're talking Cindy Anthony and Casey Anthony and Kaylee Anthony and the whole tragic case. What is the defense saying about pretrial publicity and changes of venue and all those crazy things?
Well, they have not. Well, in terms of pretrial publicity, they were the ones that fought a gag order.
Right.
And the reason they did that was because you get paid a lot less. And,
yeah.
And that's part of my issue. I don't believe for a second that Jose Baez would have led his client to trial in this case without the concept that their marketability, their market value, is significantly less when no news comes out. And that's an unfortunate truth. But there will absolutely be a change of venue in this case, but what Judge Perry has already ruled on is that wherever the change of venue is, they're going to be bused or transported to Orange County. So the pool of jurors will come from somewhere else, but the trial will take place in Orange County.
For the listener, and it would be, well, it is possible, but for the listener, try and explain that, you know, when the jury process goes on and the questions will be, have you ever heard of Casey Anthony? It would be hard to believe anyone saying, no, they haven't heard, especially down in that area, especially with all the publicity, especially with all the publicity that the Anthonys themselves took upon themselves. How is that chosen? How is that decided? Because there's no way that, you know, I suppose it is possible someone can come forward and say, Casey who? But there's been a lot covered on this story.
Well, the juror questionnaire, if I recall correctly, is something like 30 pages in this case. And you're correct. They are going to have a very difficult time seating a fair, impartial jury of her peers when, I mean, I personally think the voir dire in this case is going to take a month, at least. And that's assuming they've weeded out prior to, the voir dire itself. I really believe that. I think they're going to have it's going to kind of like be picking jurors that are the least problematic in their knowledge of the case, as opposed to having not ever heard of her or being unfamiliar. There's just no way.
No.
Now, nationally, it has calmed down somewhat.
Right.
I have seen that. But locally, I think there's a lot of things going on. I think there's been some change in the politics in the state itself. So some of that's going on in terms of different congressmen, things along those lines. So there's been some bigger issues that have kind of put it on the back burner. But as it heats up again, I have every reason to believe it's going to be, you know, as consumptive as it's been. And we're talking 5 months away. I personally do not believe that trial will take place in May.
No, I don't either.
There's no way. I would love, more than anything, to see a plea in this case.
Yep.
And I know that there's people that have so much emotion vested in following it that seems like, you know, no kind of payoff or redemption because, like you said, I mean, Casey Anthony is probably the most hated mother in the country, at least, right about now.
I think Robin Sachs and I have a $20 bet that there's going to be a plea deal. She seems to think, say that three times real fast, that there will be one, and I don't know. There's too many lawyers here getting too much publicity out of this
thing.
She's
right. Her and I agree. There's no more money. There's no more money. And not attempting a plea bargain at this point. I don't care if Mr. Baez, you know, he has three ghosts in his bedroom on the 24th clanging over his head, and he wakes up and buys the town turkeys. He is not going to be able to get out of an appellate problem.
Right.
Huge appellate problem in this case. And or civil action, in my opinion. He's got every reason to plead this case. There is no... Either you have to look at, from his perspective, you either have to look at this case and say, the state can't prove their case, I don't have to put on a defense at the end. Or, how do we defend this case? And who really believes that Casey Anthony is going to be able to withstand cross-examination in the face of what we have all seen her doing? And what happened in the face of, you know, autopsy photographs? And in the face of a jury going to, you know, the swamp where she allegedly tossed her daughter,
right,
to the extent that broke her tibia post-mortem at the distal end. It had to be hard enough at that point. And I've been to that swamp. And if you want to talk about Erie, alone, just that alone, and the vibe and the feel and the knowledge is going to be so impactful. I don't see how, at the end of the day, they walk away from their meetings and their strategy sessions and their mock trials, and they don't go, we're effed.
Yeah.
We need another plan.
Yeah.
And Wile E. Coyote is a cartoon. He's not real.
I agree, and maybe that's one of the reasons why these lawyers are dropping off like flies. There's no more interest in the case. The money stopped flowing, and the Kenny Bodden gal... I'm going to say it here. She was in it for the PR, and now to drop, who's going to turn, you know, sign on next to this group? I don't think anyone.
I don't believe that at all. I agree with you 100%. And not only that, I'm offended that these attorneys that sign on pro bono, and then legitimate with a pro hoc vice, by the way, and so they're not even practicing in the state. So they have to sign on with some... She said she was pro bono, and all of a sudden when her expenses were not covered, you know, she couldn't be bothered. Who believes that?
Yeah.
And I don't even see... You know, if I had my druthers, they would be doing a hearing where they would be examining what she'd gotten paid so far. Does it match the JAC rules of reimbursement? And if it does, she has to stay. If you sign on and you milk the cow, you bought it.
Oh, jeez. Okay. I'm just trying to...
Did I present a disturbing anti-holiday visual for everyone?
Yeah.
I apologize.
Well, you did for me. It just flashed in my mind her milking a cow. But anyway, Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Her blog, sister blog to Scared Monkeys, is blinkoncrime.com. We're down to about 3 minutes left. Blink, what else is going on? You cover it all at your blog.
I do. Well, we try. We certainly would like to have the opportunity to... So many. Unfortunately, there's so many cases that we'd like to cover. But I think there's a couple of cases that are heating on the horizon, one of which I have not written on yet, in terms of... Because this is probably the last time we'll speak, maybe before the new year, is the case of the skeleton children that are currently missing.
Yeah.
And presumed a bad end. I mean... when I saw that gentleman's parents, that would be the grandparents of the boys, in an interview the other night, my heart sank. I felt like I was watching George Anthony all over again.
Mm.
Let's talk about me. Yes, the kids are fine. Did I tell you I used to be in the war? Did I tell you I used to be a this?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, no, these people either really don't understand that there is these children are in danger, if not deceased.
Yeah.
Or don't they care?
Yeah, I don't know. It's amazing what cameras will do to people. And what's the real story? The Anthonys ran out and got a publicist right away. I don't know. It is heartbreaking. Blink from Blink on Crime. Make sure and check out her webpage. It covers all the crime stories, and she's always welcome here on the show. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Yeah, same to you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
That's Blink from Blink on Crime. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with a syndicated radio host and true crime author, crime reporter, and I'm not sure what else he's doing these days, Mike McIntyre, to talk about a couple of high-profile cases that he's been covering. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about a creepy new book about Charles Manson, and then Robin Sachs will be here to talk about the Ronnie Chasen murder. And has it really been solved? This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. My next guest you'll know is a syndicated radio host of the Crime and Punishment radio show on the Chorus and Ralco radio networks. He's a crime reporter with the Winnipeg Free Press and author of some true crime books, and I think he paints houses on the weekend. No, I'm not sure if he does that or not. Do you, Mike? Are you house painting?
I don't even paint my own house, so it would be a bad idea for me to attempt to paint really anything. I can't even finger paint, Dana.
We were just talking off air, and right after you, I'm going to have Robin, and then my last guest tonight is a guy by the name of Marlon Marinick, and he's from Regina, not too far away from me and not too far away from you. He's a psych nurse, and he talks to Charles Manson on the phone every couple of days. Now, usually you and I get telemarketers calling us. This guy gets Charles Manson calling him.
Does he call collect?
He calls collect. I've heard some of the audio. It actually says you're receiving a collect call from Corcoran Prison in California.
Wow.
And this guy wrote a book about Charles Manson and called Charles Manson Now. So who says there isn't, here you got a cop in Weyburn doing a story about a guy in Regina that talks to Charles Manson, and then we follow it up with a guy from Winnipeg who is going to talk about whatever we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, it is a strange, strange world indeed. I get a lot of calls from prison, and perhaps my most infamous one, I actually wasn't in prison. I got a call from a guy who was in the witness protection plan.
Wow.
But I've never gotten a call yet from a prolific world-famous serial killer, but I guess there's always time for that.
I would take his call. I can remember talking to John Mark Carr after he came back and confessed to killing JonBenet Ramsey, and that was a call I'll never forget. Anyway, why I have you here is I want to talk about a couple of Canadian high-profile cases, because we are simulcast here in Canada and on cable TV in Canada, and one of them is, and I understand there's a publication ban, but I want to talk about not so much Graham James, maybe we can touch a little bit on the story, but the Canadian bail system versus the American bail system, and what this whole story may do to change it.
Well, just to give listeners, if they're not familiar with Graham James, he's certainly a notorious individual here in Canada. He used to be a hockey coach, a junior hockey coach here in Canada. In fact, he coached many players who went on to have big-time careers in the National Hockey League, make oodles of money, become big celebrities. And no doubt Graham James was a very good hockey coach who I'm sure helped shape a lot of the athletic careers of these people. Unfortunately, Graham James had a much darker side as well, and he also victimized some of his former players. Back in the mid-1990s, three players came forward saying that they had been sexually molested by James in years past, and James ultimately went to jail. He was found guilty, did 3.5 years in prison, and got out of prison in the early 2000s, and in fact received a pardon for his crimes back in 2007. Fast forward to the present, and Graham James has been living in Mexico under a different name, not exactly clear what it is he's been doing in Mexico. But in the last few months, new allegations came to light. When I say new, I don't mean of offenses that are alleged to have occurred in recent years, but offenses that occurred during the same time frame for which James has already gone to prison. Three more former players, the most famous, I guess, would be Thierry Fleury, who had a tremendous National Hockey League career, played with the Calgary Flames and a couple other teams. He made allegations in a best-selling book that came out last winter that he had been molested by James while playing hockey for him. Two others have since come forward, and so Graham James is now facing a new trial, a new set of allegations. And ultimately, he flew back to Canada back in October, was arrested, and spent a couple months in jail until this past week.
Now, Mike McIntyre is here, and we're talking about Graham James. You can check out Mike's webpage at MikeOnCrime.com. Now, I'm not sure where I heard you being interviewed the other day on this. Maybe Charles Adler, I'm not sure. But you brought up the comment, or you made the comment that when the Crown, or the like they would call the DA in the United States, come forward to say that they want to keep Graham James or an individual, say Mr. Smith, in jail, one of the primary grounds to say that he has to stay in jail, or they have to prove, is that he may be a flight risk. Well, Graham James is no dummy, and neither are his attorneys when they actually bring him back from Mexico to Canada, have him turn himself in. Let's talk about that difference a little bit and what grounds you need to be able to keep someone in jail in this country.
Yeah, well, let me just say I was not surprised in the least that Graham James was released on bail. And ordered to live under a number of conditions, including that he's allowed to move to Montreal, Quebec, and live there while these charges are before the courts. I fully expected that he would get bail. I know a lot of Canadians were certainly shocked and perhaps outraged. But yeah, in Canada, there's really three grounds for which you can detain a person. Ground number one would be, as you mentioned, Dana, that they prove themselves to be a flight risk, that there's a concern that they won't show up in court. Well, the fact of the matter is, Graham James could have made life very difficult for justice officials. He could have chosen to stay in Mexico and force Canadian officials to seek to extradite him to Canada. That could have taken months, maybe even years. The fact is, Graham James willingly boarded an airplane and came back to Canada. And when he did that, I sort of knew right off the hop there's probably a method to his madness, and this was him eliminating what would probably be the best argument for keeping him in custody. How can the Crown say that he's not going to show up in court when it's through his own actions that he's even there in court to begin with? The other ground, or the other main ground, Dana, is that a person is an ongoing risk to the public, that they're a big threat to reoffend. And again, that argument falls, I think, short with James, given that these are not new criminal allegations. These are for offenses which are alleged to have occurred back in the 1980s and 1990s. And really, at the end of the day, he's already gone to prison for similar offenses during the similar time frame. Nobody's alleging that Graham James in the last 10, 15 years has done anything criminal. And so again, I think you have a hard time making that argument. The third and final ground is what's called the tertiary ground in Canada. And basically, it says that the administration of justice would be called into disrepute. Right. And that's a really odd sort of ground. You rarely see somebody detained just on that. The Crown did make that argument, but at the end of the day, the judge felt that with certain conditions, James could be released, and so he has been.
Well, nobody understands what disrepute means anyway, so...
a lot of people would argue that the system is constantly in disrepute, and how can you bring it any more into disrepute?
Exactly.
And I guess that's a debate for another day.
Mike McIntyre is here. He's a syndicated radio host, crime reporter, and true crime author. Now, let's go back a little bit, and I preface the interview by saying I want to compare Canada to the United States a little bit. If you could share with my audience, James did three and a half years. For what? How many counts?
He did 3.5 years for 100 charges, 100 charges related to three victims over many, many years. And, you know, what's going to be very interesting, Dana, to see is, let's just assume for a moment, and of course he is presumed innocent on these new charges. By the way, he's facing 9 new charges. Let's assume for a moment that he's convicted or pleads guilty. The big question is, what, if any, additional sentence would he serve? And I think in the U.S. that wouldn't be nearly the debate that it would be in Canada, because, of course, in the United States, sentences tend to be much, much longer when you're talking about especially sexual crimes.
Yeah.
In Canada, though, a 3.5-year sentence, some people may be surprised, is actually considered somewhat significant. And the fact is that if we could go back in time and these three complainants who've now come forward had come forward at the time of the other three for which he's already been sentenced, I think there's a legitimate question to ask is, would he have gotten much more than 3.5 years to begin with? And I expect that we're going to hear an argument down the road that his lawyer will probably say that Graham James has more or less paid his debt to society, and there's really not much more that should be done to him. I suspect that the prosecution will have a slightly different view, but it really will be an interesting legal debate down the road. And as I say, if we were in the States, we'd probably be talking a double-digit sentence here to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much in Canada.
Oh, yeah. 100 counts, 3 years in the States. Maybe in Ohio, I think I've covered some stories from there, but anywhere else, no way. This guy is... Don Cherry got in trouble the other day for using the term pinko, and some would say that some of the laws in this country, although they're trying to make mandatory minimums for some cases, are pinko laws. And
and there are some states. Florida comes to mind as a state which it has taken such an extreme view of sex offenses, especially against children. I mean, there's a debate, Dana, about whether they should expand the death penalty,
yep,
not just to murderers, but to child molesters. And it's a very real debate going on. So you're right. I mean, many U.S. states have taken such a dim view of it that I think Canada, in a lot of ways, really falls much, much behind. We certainly talk a good game in terms of protecting our children, but I think our actions often speak louder than words.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike McIntyre is here. Robert Latimer, again, another case from my home province. Some will say the parole is justified. Some will say he shouldn't have done any time in jail. It's a story that goes back, gosh, it's got to be 15 years now. He finally has received his parole. It's a mercy killing.
Right.
Wasn't it a mercy killing? Some will say it was premeditated. Who knows? Let's talk a little bit about Robert Latimer.
Well, and there have been very few cases that have, I think, divided the public quite like the Latimer case. And I suspect that those who feel Latimer should be home on parole with his family, those are the people from day one that most of them probably thought that Latimer was getting a raw deal from the system. Those who say he shouldn't be are the ones that fall on the other side. And really, there's not a lot of gray area in this case. Again, I find that this is one of those cases right from the get-go. People either supported Latimer strongly or were so against what he did. And you're right, some call it a mercy killing, some call it a cold-blooded murder. It has to do with his severely disabled daughter that Latimer readily admitted to ending her life. He said it was to end her suffering, and she, of course, was not in a position where she really could consent to what was being done. And, of course, there is no legalized euthanasia or mercy killing that is allowed in Canada, even if she had consented. But it really ignited a firestorm at the time, and it's one of those cases that continues to be debated. Look, at the end of the day, I don't know how anybody, no matter where you fall on this argument and this case, how anybody could argue that a Robert Latimer remains a risk to society. This is not some career criminal who killed his daughter after, you know, all kinds of other crimes. He's a unique criminal. And many, as I say, don't even look at him as a criminal. And, you know, I think he's paid a penalty for sure. He's not the kind of guy that's going to go out there and kill again. I suspect he's not going to get in really any trouble at all. And so, you know, I think this has probably been a long time coming for him. And at the end of the day, he's still serving a life sentence. If he does screw up, there are ramifications. He could very easily find himself back behind bars. I don't think the Canadian public, though, has to worry that Robert Latimer is some kind of dangerous predator.
Amen to that. I'm glad he's home for Christmas. And he spent more time in jail for ending his daughter's suffering than Graham James did for 100 counts of sexual assault. And I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. But that's
the suffering of which his victims, of course, continues to this day, no doubt.
Absolutely. And their lives were taken from them. Although they're still walking this earth, their lives will never be the same. Mike McIntyre is here. Mike, what's going on the show this weekend?
Well, of course, we are almost into the, well, we are into the Christmas season. This will be our last show before Christmas, and we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, this time of year. Of course, there's always all kinds of scams going on. Yep. You always hear those stories of people getting ripped off and robbed. I actually wrote a book many years ago on a guy who was deliberately targeting banks and armored cars around Christmas time. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of that seasonal crime, just some reminders, and drunk driving, which has always been something that I hold near and dear. We've seen far too many tragedies again already this year. So with the Christmas season upon us and, of course, a lot of celebrating going on, going to spend a little bit of time on the show again talking about drinking and driving, and hopefully remind folks to be safe this holiday season. We don't need any more tragedies than we've already had.
Amen to that. Will you be playing the Peter Warren interview?
Yeah, it's one of the most moving calls for sure that has ever come my way. And I, of course, didn't take it myself, the call, but it's a man who killed a child on Christmas Eve following an office Christmas party many years ago, called into Peter's show, and I can't think of a better way to hammer home the message than by replaying this man's very dramatic call to Warren, which Peter's asked me to continue to play around this time of year, just as a reminder to people. This is a man who, you hear it in his voice, is absolutely tortured by the damage he caused, the life he took, and as we find out at the very end of it all, this man ultimately took his own life, unable to live with the guilt. So for sure, we'll be replaying that.
Yeah, it's an excellent piece of tape, and I encourage everyone to listen to Mike's show this Sunday. Mike McIntyre, his webpage is mikeoncrime.com. His radio show is Crime and Punishment, heard Sundays on the Chorus and Rolco Radio Networks. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Happy holidays to everyone.
Talk to you soon, buddy.
Bye-bye.
That's Mike McIntyre. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to come back with Robin Sachs here on Scared Monkeys Radio. My next guest, you'll know Robin Sachs as a former ADA from Los Angeles County. She's a author. Her most recent books, Everything I Know About Parenting I Learned in Court, and Raising the Bar, or is it called Raised in the Bar? I'm not sure. We'll talk about that in a second. As a favorite guest here, she's also a NBC News analyst and a victims advocate, and always welcome on the program. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Last time we talked, we were talking about Ronnie Chasen. There was a lot of speculation going on out there. We weren't sure what was going on. There was questions about forensics, ballistics, you name it. And it looks like the case was solved. Can you bring my audience up to date on what's going on with that case?
Well, one of the wackiest cases to hit Hollywood, Hollyweird, it doesn't get any weirder than what we've seen happen with twists and turns in the last few weeks. It's been 4 weeks since Ronnie Chasen was murdered in Beverly Hills on Sunset as she drove home from the masquerade premiere party at the W Hotel in Hollywood on her way home in a Mercedes-Benz when she was apparently gunned down, shot, and her car plunged forward a few feet or a few yards and then ended up crashing into a pole, and she died at the scene. Actually, I apologize, she did not die at the scene. She ended up dying at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, which is the local hospital nearby.
Right.
In any case, right immediately following the report, there's lots of different pieces of speculation, as we all know, that came about. everything from art deals gone bad to gambling debts not paid to poor business habits to the brother to the not the brother to other family members and so forth. And it ended where we had a Harold Martin Smith, the Harvey Apartments, apparently had been touting around that he knocked off the, Ronnie Chasen, that he was given $10,000 from it, where reports were made from some of the neighbors in the apartment. He was an unusual person known to wear gray gardening gloves as he walked around. He had done some prison stints. There's been some prior robberies, so forth. Police approached to talk to him about 2 weeks ago, and upon approach, he apparently shoots himself in the head and it dies at the scene. Following that, the police waited about a week to inform the public of what was going on. There was an original announcement that the gun in the suicide of Harold Martin Smith did not match that of the ballistics of Ronnie Chasen's murder. And then another report came out following that a week later that, in fact, the gun did match. The Beverly Hills Police Department actually held a press conference with the goal. Their goal, stated goal of that press conference was to just to come out and say that the guns match. But it was a press conference that was kind of a stone running downhill, and it became a press conference that turned into the police saying publicly to everyone that we believe that Harold Martin Smith was person who shot the gun at Ronnie Chasen. They said that the guns matched. They believe that he acted alone. They believe that there were no other suspects, but yet the case was only 50 to 70% done and that they were still investigating other leads.
Yeah.
You just named on national television in front of millions of people the killer, the motive, which they said was a robbery gone bad, and yet they say the case is still open. Everyone hears heads are scratching because is it open, is it not? The police won't say, and yet there's no feeling of safety satiation because the facts just still don't make sense. There's been so many erroneous reports, as Beverly Hills Police Department likes to say, so we don't know really what the state of the evidence was. There was reports originally that there was 5 shots, 2 Ronnie Chasen, 3 in the chest, 2 in the shoulder, which suggested a skilled marksman. There was allegations that this was, you know, a potential hit or looked like a hit based on the shooting style, but yet, and also just given the area in Beverly Hills where this happens, it's not a high crime area. Thinking that someone rode a bike 7 miles, or even if they used a bus, seems awfully far to go for a robbery, and he never stole anything or took anything when he had the opportunity. No one recognized him or saw him there, and this guy is kind of a nut. And, you know, there's still a lot of questions here. The casings weren't found, so then it seems like, okay, so he rides his bike and then picks up the casings and doesn't steal anything. He does all that. It's just a lot of questions, not making sense. Everything, the general consensus around here is that something smells in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, you know, and you're right, and that's why I brought it up tonight, because this case has gone from strange to stranger, and I think the Beverly Hills PD and some in the media on some of the cable news shows have put their foot in their mouths when they reported on this story, and it's far from being over. But let's look at this, Robin. Robin Sachs is here. Her webpage is robinsachs.com. Let's look at this nut that went to the school board meeting in Florida, pulled the gun, and ended up getting taken out by a former cop, a retired cop, school security officer, and then the guy took his own life. The system and allowing these loons back out on the street, I know we can't keep them in indefinitely. The mental health system, the way that it is, I think the guy in Florida, there have been reports, has been diagnosed as bipolar. This guy in the Chasen situation was walking around with rubber gloves on or oven mitts on all the time or some weird stuff. What's going on with the system and these Looney Tunes that are out running around killing people?
Well, the Looney Tunes, I mean, you know, it's kind of like the Looney Tunes are running the hospital right now, is the way it's like out here, because, you know, with the budget and our completely ineffective, inept criminal justice system, leaves very little options for the mentally ill, and therefore puts people at a risk all the time. And I know that, you know, we have to constantly weigh our freedoms and our rights, but here you have, especially in this, you know, Harold Martin Smith case, I mean, this is a guy who is on parole, who's had, you know, number of incarcerations. You know, there's got to be more that we can do to evaluate and look at what we're doing once we release people back into the community. I think that our system is so front-loaded that all we think about is kind of the investigation and the conviction, and then it's like the sentence is the win, but no one really thinks about the reality. It's like, so what? You get 25 years to life. If they actually end up releasing the person in 5 years, it's no longer 25 years to life. I don't care that the sentencing report reads 25 years to life. We want that person not causing crime for other people. So, I was talking with actually a polygrapher about some of the rules that they use for sex offenders in other states. For example, in Texas, and in order to remain free out of custody, if you're on parole for a sex crime in Texas, that you have to subject yourself at your own cost, that being the defendant's cost to himself, of a polygraph once a month to see that they haven't been committing any crimes. Now, some people would say that's an unbelievable burden and that's completely unfair, but, I mean, if you're subjecting someone to monitoring and being there, there's more chance of catching, you know, these would-be nutbags out there from committing more crimes and really protecting them from themselves.
Yeah, they call it up here, what the hell is it? Not criminally responsible. And in the States, insanity defense, whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter. Some get committed to mental health facilities indefinitely. Some are in for a little while. We all think of the goof that shot Ronald Reagan, and he's always trying to get out on passes and out for a walk and stuff like that. But from the prosecutor's perspective, Robin, when a case goes that way, either the accused is not criminally responsible or has been found not guilty by insanity and get into that mental hospital, is that it when it comes to the court system, the DA's office, and then it becomes a health issue? Because, you know, 5 years, like you say, they would have been serving a life sentence if they'd have been convicted. But in 2 or 3 years, if a doctor thinks they're okay and puts them on a bunch of pills, they could be out walking the streets again.
Well, that's exactly the problem is that when there is a determination, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different mental where the ways that the mental health system, I mean, that are beyond just not guilty by reasons of insanity. I mean, that's one way. But the other kind of classic situation that happens out here a lot is that people are determined to be not fit to stand trial at all. And therefore, what ends up happening is that they then get subject to examination. They're not even able to stand trial because the standard is to be able to assist in their own defense. And, you know, we saw kind of with the Elizabeth Smart how many years he feigned that. And what happens in California and many states is that you are brought back, the defendant would be brought back into the courtroom, you know, every so often to kind of have a progress report and seeing if the defendant is any more fit to stand trial or not. Well, who gets prejudiced by the fact that by the time the defendant is fit to stand trial, the case is now 10 years old, the DA is gone, the evidence is gone, the witnesses have moved away, and now he's ready for his trial? So that's even worse almost than being sentenced and at least convicted of the crime. Then in these cases, a lot of people who were arrested and investigated for a crime never even get convicted of them because they're not, the prosecutors are unable to proceed based on the prejudice to them based on the amount of time that's lapsed. So it's a very sick system that needs some repair and needs some health spent on it in terms of figuring out what we can do to make it stronger and make it make sense.
Robin Sachs is here. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.robinsachs.com. Last question. Charles Manson gets caught with a cell phone here a few weeks ago. I'm recording this interview with you, so I've already interviewed a guy that he called tonight and spent some time talking to on the phone. There's a guy that's been kept in the system, will never get out, Looney Tune right down to the last degree. What's the difference between Charles Manson, that very high-profile case, and the guy that walked into the school board meeting the other day with the gun?
Well, I mean, from a different point of view, I mean, listen, right now, first of all, the notoriety to Charles Manson will never, I don't want to say never be compared, you know, one that can be compared to, but this was, I mean, the Charles Manson case, there's so much to it because it was a case where Charles Manson was convicted for murder when he never even, where the allegations were that he never even actually killed anyone.
Right.
It was a very legally challenging case that Vincent Bugliosi put on with Stephen Kay back in the 70s, where it was, you know, an opportunity to see if a cult leader could be responsible for the actions of their cult followers. And that's how that case was prosecuted and dealt with. And the best proof that they had in that case was Charles Manson's behavior in court and then the behavior of the followers in court. I mean, when he put the swastika on his head, they put a swastika on their head. The guy in the schoolyard, in the school board situation is a bit different. In that situation, you're talking direct, you know, mental illness with direct outcome and result of mental outcome. And I think from a wrapping your brain around the kind of way, it's, you know, kind of run of the mill of someone going nuts these days and shooting up wherever. They don't want, you know, disgruntled employees. I mean, that's old hat. Charles Manson, even to this day, there's not been a case that's been quite like it in terms of that mastermindness. The other thing is, you have to remember, this was like one of the first kind of times where media, I mean, really, right. really, I mean, the cameras outside of the courtroom were unbelievable back in the Charles Manson. I mean, it was the real precursor to the O.J. Lands and changed the way, changed, you know, what we know now as Trial of the Centuries.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, her website is www.robinsacks.com. Always a pleasure. Happy holidays to you, ma'am.
Thank you. Thanks for having me and accommodating my crazy schedule today. And tune in for Larry King's last show. It's tonight.
Oh, that's right, too. Yeah, are you on it?
No, I'm not, but I am going. That's why I can't be with you live. I'm going to attend the celebration and after party.
Absolutely.
With Stacey Honowitz, who you may know, Florida prosecutor Stacey Honowitz, and I are going to hang out before. So I'm looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Have fun there.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Robin Sacks, and, you know, I hope she has fun at Larry King's party tonight. A hostess with the mostess. There won't be another Larry King. This Pierce Brooks, or whatever his name is. I never heard of him before. He's on Dancing with the Skaters or something. I'm not sure if he'll be able to carry much of an audience, but who knows? I could be wrong. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are right back. I want to put a little disclaimer or a caution for the next interview. If you're easily offended, well, then you've never listened to my show before. Marlon Marinick is here, and he's written a book about Charles Manson. He talks to Charles Manson on the phone like you and I talk to a friend. Charlie gives him a phone call, and they talk. And he decided to write a book about their conversations, and we pre-recorded this interview a little earlier on, and I just want to warn you, there are a couple of graphic comments that are made, but it's hard to not talk about Charles Manson without making those types of comments. Again, the book is Charles Manson Now, and it's a fascinating book. I think Merlin's going to be on Dr. Phil here in a few days talking about it, and yeah. You know, you and I get telemarketers calling us. He gets Charles Manson calling him. All right. Who would think that when you answer the telephone that you would have Charles Manson on the other end? I'm not sure if my next guest ever thought that that would happen. But there is a new book out now called Charles Manson Now. For those of you watching this on Access 7, you will probably have heard of Marlon Marinick and his new book. And, of course, go to the show notes to pick up on the webpage and buy the book, of course. He's written a book about Charles Manson, and when you look at it and you think about Charles Manson, of course, Helter Skelter and all that sort of stuff, I can remember reading that as a kid and literally being freaked out about it. And when I look on the webpage, one of our regular guests here, Diane Diamond, says, Marlon's soulful search for meaning takes many twists and turns, and the reader gets to go along for the fascinating ride. And I thought, Jesus, it's going to be fascinating to bring on Marlon Marinick, who's just down the road from me, and welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Dana.
Nice to have you. Charles Manson Now. I know you're in the business, and not the Charles Manson business, but in the psychiatric business. You have been for a long time. You're a registered psychiatric nurse. Whatever got you to talk to and then eventually write a book about Charles Manson?
It's kind of it was a weird series of coincidences almost that everything came together. It was never my intention to seek him out. I wasn't really familiar with the murders. Of course, I knew who he was, but I didn't really know who he was. As a child, I found a copy of Helter Skelter, and to me, it was I was kind of terrified by this evil guy, and he was this monster. And in writing the book, I had to go back to that and try to remember, you know, where did I first, hear about Manson? And so it kind of goes back to then. And, of course, I have a career in psychiatry, and he's always been an interest from that perspective.
When you think about Charles Manson, and I'm interviewing a former DA from Los Angeles County tonight, and we've talked about Manson before with her, and we've talked about the media perspective long before O.J. Simpson and all the media that made O.J. Simpson. The media actually was a big part of Charles Manson. Charles Manson's no dummy. We've all seen him doing his little shtick. And that's my term with Geraldo, you know, where he's dancing around and telling stories. I find him to be very articulate, very scary, obviously, and probably has a lot of psychiatric issues. But let's go to Charles Manson and talk about Charles Manson with the media. That story was probably one of the first big true crime stories that the media was all over.
Yeah, and it's a story that's never died down. Last year was the 40th anniversary of the murders. And I just found out recently that the public relations people at Corcoran, the prison that Charlie's housed in, got over 2,000 interview requests from around the world, you know, just around the month of August of last year. So, and he gets requests all the time for interviews and thousands of letters from all over the world. It's unbelievable. And that's part of what I found fascinating is why, 40 years later, is this guy still relevant, you know?
But he knows how to work the camera.
Mm-hmm.
He can look at that camera and he can do his routine. But then when you again, and I encourage everyone that's listening to go to the website, charlesmansonnow.com, and there's a link in the show notes if you're not listening live and you're picking up the podcast, and listen to some of the audio. I think it's very interesting, the perspective of the book. And the little, you've got two or three audio clips or whatever on the webpage. When you sat down and you've actually met him face to face, and a lot of this is the recording. You can even hear that you're the recording in the background. You're getting a call from a prisoner, whatever, playing in the background here. How do you cipher as an author what's going to be in the book and what isn't going to be in the book, or how difficult was that?
When I proposed the idea of doing a book to Manson, and his first reaction was, "No way! You know, I'm not. There's been 140 books. They're all bullshit. We don't need another one. So, you know, save the trees, kind of thing." And so the guidelines kind of were that I would use. I wouldn't manipulate his words. I wouldn't try and analyze them. I wouldn't edit anything. And so his part in the book is kind of a separate. Part that follows is kind of in interplaced between the chapters, and it's just him. And there's no real censorship. It's just, you know, it's who he really is. And a lot of it is, you know, some of it might be considered, you know, sick, or you know, some of it might be considered wisdom, or some of it, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of all over the place, and that's kind of left to the reader to interpret whatever it is. The other thing that he thought was important was that he thought I should write about my own journey, my own experience, and try to keep it current. So the thing that separates this book from every other Manson book is that most of the other books are missing that one element, which is Manson.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, I consulted and kind of interviewed and worked with all of his best friends inside of prison, outside of prison. So it's a comprehensive look at who Charles Manson is today.
Marlon Marinick's here. We're talking about his new book, Charles Manson Now. You know, the Regina Correctional Center is one thing, but you go to Cochrane Prison. Mm-hmm. in California. What was that experience like?
It's got a weird energy about it. It's like a kind of impending doom or something. And it was really quiet when I remember it was like this lowing fog when I went out. And it was almost like a movie when I first met him. He's in an extremely secure unit called PHU, which is a protective housing unit. And the reason he's there is in the 80s, he was, I can't remember which prison he was in, but he was set on fire by another inmate. Someone threw lighter fluid on him, and he almost died. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like a liability. If something happened to this guy in prison, what do we do? And so PHE was kind of designed around housing him, and Sirhan Sirhan was there, and a couple other high-profile inmates, a lot of gang informants, some sex offenders that have done things so horrible that they can't be in population. So it's just to keep them safe and out of population. There's 15 inmates. One of them just got transferred today, and it's originally designed for 42 guys. So he has his own cell. He's kind of a minimalist by default. I mean, you're not allowed a whole lot of stuff in prison. And most of those guys, there's not a whole lot of movement. They've all been in there for like 10 or more years, more or less.
There's an interesting quote on your webpage from him. He wrote the foreword of your book. The prison becomes your mind because people come in and people go out. People get jobs and they serve a function and they abide by certain rules and there's nobody there but you. You know, how interesting was that to hear him? Because he seems like he rambles on sometimes and then he I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, he seems to make sense.
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of that is, here's a guy, a man who spent 65 years in prison, over more than half of that in solitary confinement. And so he's kind of forced to go into things and deal with thoughts and figure some things out. And that quality, he has some insights and stuff that, you know, border on, you know, being a mystic or something or spiritual, whatever. And I think that's part of the fascination for a lot of people.
A talented musician, although as some media you'll see that he was more of a wannabe than anything, but doesn't matter, he was involved in that whole culture. How much of that culture from the 50s and 60s is still part of Charles Manson?
Well, I've been a musician for most of my life, and that's kind of one of the connections, and so we've talked a lot about that, and he's wrote songs with the Beach Boys, like two of that have been recorded. His music's been recorded by, like, countless bands. He was friends with Neil Young. Neil Young gave him a motorcycle. He used to hang out with Jim Morrison, Frank Zappa. Played cards in Elvis's house. There's a lot of... He played with the Grateful Dead in San Francisco once. He's got a... It's almost a tragedy because I think at one point he was one of those guys who could have done something. You know, I think he had that kind of potential.
When you look at this in 40 years, I've interviewed people. There's an outfit in Los Angeles called Dearly Departed Tours that makes a pilgrimage. He actually takes it. It's like the Hollywood Houses tour. They go and they tour all the places of the Manson killing. What does he think of the public's still fascination with this 40 years later?
He doesn't understand it. When I was working on this book, he's a little apprehensive about everything, and I wouldn't necessarily, I'll say paranoid, sure, and he's wondering what my motives are, like, what's going to happen with this book, what's the follow-up going to be kind of thing, and he asked me how I would feel if people started writing books about me, and I never looked at it from that perspective, and so here's a guy who just basically wants to be left alone, and every time he turns on the TV, there he is, you know, and he's referenced everywhere, and he's grandiose, but it kind of feeds into that, right? Because it validates everything to a certain extent.
On your page, you have, at times he was engaging, funny, and prophetic. Mm-hmm. At other times, he seemed like he was the meanest SOB I ever met. How one person could embody all those extremes, I really don't know. You've been in the psychiatric business for a long time. Mm-hmm. Have you ever met anyone like Charles Manson?
Never. He's the most complex being I've ever met. Like, absolutely. I've met people who are more more violent, more mentally ill, more psychotic, more everything, you know. But with him, I wouldn't say he's transparent, but he changes quite a bit, and you never know who you're exactly dealing with. You know, sometimes, he's pretty passionate about things, and other times he's really direct and confrontive, and I've seen that side of him too.
The first time you met, you saw him face to face. How prophetic was that for you?
It was kind of weird because we knew each other because we'd been talking on the phone, and I don't know how, but he ended up in the visiting room before I did. And initially, I assumed it would be like, you know, you'd be separated between glass, or you'd have phones to talk to each other or whatever. But you're in an open room, and there's a couple guards that sit in a kind of a kiosk in the middle, and you have, you know, you have, we had a table set up by the vending machines. He had a table set up, and he had a chessboard out, which is another thing I thought was bizarre. I don't even know how to play chess. And you know, we kind of got past introductions and stuff, and when things were kind of calmed down, he stood up and pushed his chair back, and he started yelling, and, you know, like, extremely loud, and he's, like, reenacting this whole bank robbery, like, "Get down, I'll kill you," you know, like, that kind of a tone, and the guards were, like, ready to end the visit, and I thought, well, this is, you know, this is over, and this whole thing played out in about 90 seconds or so, and then when he sat down, I said, "What was that all about?" And he was saying, "Well, that was level 7. And I'm like, "Okay." I had no idea what he was saying. And he was explaining that it's like a level of awareness or consciousness where he lives. And he said it's, his analogy was like, if you're almost in a car accident or something, how time kind of slows down and you're able to, everything kind of has a different rhythm to it. And it's kind of driven by fear, and he says that's how his whole existence is. And he took a lot of time to explain, you know, how he ended up where he is. He talked a lot about his childhood. He talked a lot about being in jail, you know, relationships, that kind of stuff.
Marlon Marinick's here talking about his new book, Charles Manson Now. When he did that, yeah, I truly believe he was testing you, and he's, I don't know, built up a trust. When's the last time you've heard from him?
2 days ago, night before last. He tried calling yesterday, but wasn't around. So I do, and it's kind of weird because if you talk to him every day, he, you know, things are cool and he's okay with everything. But if I was in New York doing press for the book and stuff, so I was away for a while and hadn't spoken to him for 2 weeks, and so, you know, he's comes on really aggressive, you know. I don't know. He's a different character.
He just got caught with a cell phone, I thought I heard in the media.
Yeah, that was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, actually.
Oh.
I have no idea why it's making its rounds now, and I actually thought about writing that in the book, but, it just, you know.
Leave it to...
I should have, because it would have got a lot of press.
Leave it to the media. Wow, that's something. Listen, I appreciate you coming on, and I got to ask you this question. I always ask authors this question. When I'm walking through chapters, or I'm on the internet, or I'm wherever, and I see that face looking at me on the cover, Charles Manson Now, that's going to pique my interest. Mm-hmm. But when I pick up the book and I open it, what in your book is going to want me to buy your book?
Oh, okay. I'll try to explain this shortly. As I said earlier, when I was a child, and I have a dysfunctional childhood, and that's part of what I go into in the book, and I got an introduction to Charlie through Helter Skelter. He was this monster. And then in the next chapter, chapter two, I go into training to deal with the monster, which is psychiatry. And then in chapter three, I went through a series of events, a lot of loss, really, really difficult time. And during that period is when I started talking to Charlie on the phone, and it opened up this whole experience where I started meeting all these people that were close to him, and they showed me different aspects of this monster, right? And so I start piecing together who this guy is, and then eventually I meet him, and I reflect on the whole experience. So the book is written like a journey. It's from a personal perspective, and the feedback I've been getting from people who've read it it's been very, very. I'm kind of flustered, actually. I'm very surprising that people got it. You know,
I'm hearing a lot of good things about it, and I'll share this with you. A couple of years ago, Charlie was doing one of his famous parole hearings, and I do a daily commentary on my webpage, and I did a commentary about Charles Manson. And it's still up on YouTube, amazing, got 100,000+ hits on it. In fact, they ended up having to shut off the comments because a lot of them were very nasty towards me. But the comment I made, and we'll end up with this, I'll set the stage and let you go with it, is that I was surprised that Charles Manson has been able to survive in prison this long. And I was getting accused of asking that he be taken out and a hit put on him and all sorts of things. That wasn't my point. My point is someone like like him, because we all hear about the serial killers and all those that go to prison, but eventually the prison gets to them. Why has Charles Manson been able to survive?
That's one of those mysteries, and I've talked a lot to him about that. And you know, he doesn't take direct questions very well. Like, I've asked him, like, how do you get out of bed every day, man? Like, how do you deal with this? And his response was, well, my dick still gets hard. You know, he never. I don't know if that's okay for your podcast.
That's all right.
That's kind of the way he is, and he said stuff like, anybody in my situation would have killed themselves, you know. And
right.
And I can honestly say, and this sounds almost like a contradiction, but I don't know anybody who's fought as hard as he has to stay alive. That's all he cares about is his air and, you know, his environment, and that's, you know, he tries to eat healthy, he tries to get exercise. I would have given up 40 years ago, man. I really would have. And
yeah.
I don't really know what the answer to that is. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and you're right. Just look at him. For 76, I think he is. He looks like he's been, you know, taking care of himself, that's for sure. The book is Charles Manson Now. Click on the show notes, and you can go right to the webpage and order the book there. The author, Marlon Marinick. Thank you, sir. I'd like to do this again sometime.
Yeah, no problem, Dean. It's cool that we're in the same neighborhood.
Not too far away, just an hour away. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, you know, when you're talking about Charles Manson, I apologize to any of those of you that were offended by some comments that were made. When I play this, you know, please beware, this is an adult show, but you're talking about a unique personality, Charles Manson, and some things like that are going to come out. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Again, that book is Charles Manson Now. Click on the link in the show notes and pick up the book. It's a fascinating story. I try and get Marlon back on the show again to talk more about that. Like I say, could you imagine having Charles Manson giving you a call every couple of days to see how you're doing? Can't stand answering the phone at the best of times. Anyway, our webpage is scaredmonkeysradio.com. You can pick up the show live there, pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, leave comments, and do whatever you think that you need to do at the webpage. We do the program for you, and without you, the program wouldn't be very much fun for sure. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.